Tonight, for our third lecture, we begin by focusing on what is at the epicenter of Judaism and what is most important for religious Jews. And that, of course, is food.
The Tikva Fund is proud to present The Haggadah, a political classic, a series of 8 audio recordings that together make up a full course on the most beloved and most popular work of Jewish liturgy. Our teacher is Rabbi Dr. Meir Soloveitchik of Congregation Sherith Israel, the oldest Jewish congregation in the United States. Rabbi Soloveitchik is also the director of the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. In these lectures, you'll hear Rabbi Soloveitchik explore the text of the Haggadah as a source of political and moral wisdom, bringing out its deeper arguments about family, memory, and the human condition, about politics and freedom, about history and sacrifice. This episode is The Politics of Time.
And I mean this quite seriously, for in considering the importance of food for Judaism in general and for Passover, for Pesach in particular, we must contrast Judaism with other ancient sophisticated civilizations. Thus, the food writer John McQuaid tells us that for thousands of years, scientists and philosophers have viewed taste and flavor as less than worthy subjects for study. The ancient Greeks considered the experience of eating, meaning taste, to be the lowest and grossest form of the senses. Vision, for the Greeks, can discern the subtleties of high art or the smile of a loved one. But for the Greeks, taste's mission is simple, to distinguish food from everything else. The Greeks thought the temptations it posed in carrying out that mission clouded the mind. So the Greeks loved vision and were suspicious of taste of eating. Judaism, of course, disagreed. Indeed, it insisted on the exact opposite. The visual images, statues, icons, these Judaism was genuinely worried about. Vision is a danger. Ve'lo taturu acharei levavachem v'acharei einechem. Be not led astray by your hearts and by your eyes. Meanwhile, Judaism has always placed eating at the center of its ritual and indeed at the center of its theology, so that our virtues are imbibed as children, not only intellectually, but physically, so that we can taste our values on the tip of our tongue. Thus, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik has noted in his classic philosophical essay, From There You Shall Seek, Uvikashtem Misham, and here I cite my own translation, my own rendering from the Hebrew into English. The act of eating, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, this animalistic function on which the life of man depends, was changed through the halakha and transformed into religious worship and an act of great ethical value. V'achaltem sham lifnei Hashem Elokeichem. You shall eat there in Jerusalem, says the Torah, eat before the Lord your God. A commandment such as this, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, is incomprehensible to Greek philosophy. For the Greeks, an animal eats while man thinks and recognizes the spiritual. It is the intellect for the Greeks that draws close to the divine, not the stomach. And you shall eat before the Lord your God. Can there be any two great opposites than these, meaning eating and experiencing God? Nevertheless, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, the halakha prefers eating before God over prayer. By the way, that sentence is my favorite quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik. If I had had a yearbook, which I didn't, that would have been my yearbook quote. The halakha prefers eating before God over prayer, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. As he continues, eating sacrifices, eating the Paschal lamb, eating Maaser Sheni, the second tithe, eating matzah, eating the offerings of joy on the 3 festivals, all these are biblical commandments of the Torah's 613 commandments according to all opinions, while prayer is counted among the biblical commandments only according to Maimonides. With this in mind, we cannot examine the Haggadah as a political text. Indeed, we cannot examine the Haggadah at all if we do not reflect on the fact that foods are utilized not only in eating, but as symbols of ideas. And that there is one food in particular that takes on a politically profound symbolism in itself. And that is matzah. unleavened bread. Thus, the Seder begins with a Kiddush, the pronouncement of sacred time. And therein we describe the festival of freedom in the following way. Vatitan lano Hashem Elokeinu bi'ahava, moadim le'simcha, you have given us, Lord our God, with love, festivals for joy, et yom chag ha-matzot hazeh, this festival of matzah, zman chirutenu, the anniversary and the time of our freedom. Meaning we choose matzah, unleavened bread, a food, as a political symbol, as the embodiment of liberty. Matzah means freedom. And such a notion would be unthinkable for most well-known Western works of political thought. One cannot imagine Plato in the Republic, after discussing the ideal polis, we'll have a philosopher king, poets will be banned. You can't imagine him all of a sudden concluding, and the supreme symbol of our polis shall be this box of Manischewitz matzah. You just cannot see it. It sounds ludicrous, and yet that is precisely what we do. Vatitan lano Hashem Elokeinu bi'ahava, et yom chag ha-matzot hazeh, zman chirutenu. What represents chirut? What is the biblical name for the festival of freedom? There is only one name, chag ha-matzot, the festival of unleavened bread. Even more odd is the fact that as part of holding up matzah as the symbol of freedom, we also, in tandem, go out of our way in preparation for the Festival of Freedom to rid ourselves of matzah's antithesis, which is, of course, chametz, leaven. And we Jews take this very seriously. This, too, is relevant to our examination of the Haggadah as a self-contained work. The standard text of the Haggadah does not begin with the Seder of Passover Eve. Rather, it starts with what occurs the night before, Bi'ur Chametz, the search for and the destroying of leftover leaven, which is followed by the burning the next morning of a small piece of bread, a ritual itself concluded by what the rabbinic texts call Bitul, the mental and verbal nullification of any leaven left in our possession, so that we say, any Chametz that is left in our homes, Livatel v'levei hefker, it shall be nullified in our minds and legally ownerless, ka'afra de'ara, like the dirt of the earth. So we prepare for the festival of liberation, which is symbolized by one food, matzah, by going out of our way to do everything we can to rid ourselves of another food, which we for some reason see as the antithesis of the food symbolizing freedom, which is chametz. And this is very important to Jews. One of my favorite news stories about preparations for Passover appeared some years ago in New York Magazine with the wonderful headline, Monkeys Say Dayenu, with the subheadline, It's That Time of Year Again at the Zoo, when the monkeys get fat and lazy thanks to Orthodox Jews. And basically, what this article describes is how Jews in Manhattan bring their chametz to Central Park, to the zoo, to throw their chametz to the animals, okay, which may be technically illegal, but nevertheless, that is what they do. And I quote, security has been tight this week at the Central Park Zoo with ticket takers, staff, and guards on the lookout for suspicious packages of cookies, pretzels, hot dog buns, and pound cake. Observant Jews have till Wednesday to clear their houses of chametz, leavened products, before Passover. And every year, many of them take their cast-offs to the zoo. Baffled zoo staff note that the snow monkeys are the main beneficiaries of the pre-holiday pig out, apparently because the polar bear's glass wall is too high and the sea lions would only be interested if offered gefilte fish. Quote, says zoo spokesperson Kate McIntyre, if a big group comes in carrying bags, admission is going to notice. The small pink-faced snow monkeys may not mind the interruption to their grooming routine and carefully prepared diet of fruits, but their caretakers sure do. Standard protocol is to politely ask food throwers to stop. If they persist, security hovers and asks again. Last year, one food flinger said to security, quote, I don't answer to you. I answer to a higher power. But they are rarely ejected. Quote, they really don't know why they shouldn't do it, says one zoo volunteer. They think they're doing a good deed. I can't say they like it when I tell them to stop. My answer to them is to take it to a shelter. Interestingly, the writer of the article then goes on to seek to interview a rabbi about these chametz-throwing zoo visitors. And at the Orthodox Union, the author reaches a rabbi by the name of, I am not making this up, Rabbi Moshe Elephant, to interview him about the zoo. But that's a discussion for another time. So Jews take this very seriously. But if we remove ourselves and stand aside objectively and view ourselves as an outsider views us, how is this not ridiculous? We begin the Festival of Freedom with an assault on bread? What does this all have to do with liberty? What could this all possibly teach us about the nature of freedom? The answer, I will suggest this evening, lies in comprehending a uniquely Jewish notion of time. And in order to ponder this point, we must consider the most important artistic reflection on the nature of time, which is one of the cinematic achievements of our age. I'm sure many of you have seen the movie Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray as Phil Connors, a cynical and selfish weatherman who travels to the town of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, in order to do a puff piece on the emergence of the groundhog in that locale, or as he puts it in his broadcast, in perhaps the greatest line in the movie, "This is the one time that live television just cannot capture the drama of a large rodent predicting the weather," end quote. After treating everyone in the town rudely, he goes to sleep in his motel, wakes up the next day only to experience Groundhog Day once again. He keeps waking up morning after morning in Punxsutawney, and it's always February 2nd, with the radio always blaring, "It's Groundhog Day." At first, Murray's character embraces his time stasis, realizing that he could do whatever he wants without consequences, as he'll just wake up again, start the day over. He eventually grows frustrated, however, and attempts to commit suicide, but still wakes up in his bed on February 2nd. Finally, having come to know in intricate detail everything that happens in the town on that day, he focuses on using every minute toward a good purpose. He saves the lives of those who died on that day. He fixes flat tires of those in need. He enjoys art, and he learns to love. Finally, having spent every instant of February 2nd in a proper way, having lived a perfect day, he wakes up the next morning, and it is finally February 3rd. Tomorrow finally came. In other words, only after Phil has grown to appreciate the preciousness of time is he actually allowed to experience time. Now, for anyone here who didn't see the movie, I apologize for completely ruining it for you. But for those of you who did see it, what I bet you do not know is that the film's plot is based on a statement by Maimonides in his Sefer HaMitzvot, in his book of the Commandments. I say this facetiously, but also somewhat seriously. And by the way, I was once speaking in a synagogue, I think in Los Angeles, and I said, many people there are on movies, and I said, this is actually based on a statement of Maimonides, this movie script. And somebody in the audience says, "Well, you know, my cousin wrote the script of Groundhog Day." And I said to her, "Your cousin is Maimonides?" Maimonides says the follows. You see, the first mitzvah given on the eve of the Exodus for the rabbis is the obligation to establish the Jewish calendar. Before the Paschal Lamb is introduced, before the laws of Matzah and Chametz are communicated, Moshe is told the following: "Hachodesh hazeh lachem rosh chadashim. This month, Nisan, shall be lachem, for you, the first month." And for the Talmudic understanding of this law, the word lachem, for you, is critical. The determination of Jewish time is given to the people. Shabbat, the Sabbath, that sacred time comes no matter what we do. But the construction of the calendar, determining based on the new moon when precisely holidays will fall out, that is given into the hands of the sages, of the Sanhedrin, who would wait every 29 days to see if witnesses saw the new moon, and then they would decide whether to start a new month and when precisely holidays should fall out. Then Rambam asks, what about today? What about now when there is no Sanhedrin? How does Jewish time move forward? Here, Maimonides tells us that by the word lachem, to you, the Torah really means that Jewish time is given to the Jewish people, who are merely represented by the Sanhedrin. But when our rabbinic representatives are unable to continue setting the calendar, then our representatives become all of the Jews living in the land of Israel. And the fact that the Jews living in the Holy Land continue to keep a set, prepared Jewish calendar, that is what actually establishes the continuation of Jewish time all over the world. Meaning, it is the fact that Jews in Israel will mark this Sabbath as Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the beginning of the new month of Nisan. That is what makes it the new month of Nisan here in America for us. Maimonides then adds the following fascinating statement. He says, if at any point in Jewish history there would cease to be a Jewish presence in the Holy Land, then the calendar, like in Groundhog Day, he doesn't mention the movie, but he says, then the calendar would grind to a halt. So, if on the 15th of Nisan there were suddenly no more Jews living in the Holy Land, there would be no 16th of Nisan. Pesach would not end. Shavuot would not arrive. Yom Kippur would never come. Of course, Maimonides rushes to assure us, God has guaranteed that there will always be a Jewish presence in the Holy Land. So the calendar will continue. Maimonides thus asserts that the continuity of Jewish time is intimately bound up with a Jewish national presence in its land, and that Jewish peoplehood is intimately connected with its ability and its responsibility to sanctify time. And here I would suggest that perhaps Maimonides is speaking not only in a technical halachic sense, but philosophically as well. For one can suggest that it was due to the establishment of Abraham in the Promised Land that through that event, the Jews actually bequeathed to the world the notion that time can move forward, that time can change, that we are free to change it, and that we are therefore free to change ourselves. Thomas Cahill, a non-Jew, once wrote a best-selling book called The Gifts of the Jews, How a Tribe of Desert Nomads Changed the Way Everyone Thinks and Feels. Therein he notes that the ancient world saw time as inherently cyclical. History never progressed, and people never improved. In the ancient world, in Sumer and Maya and China and Greece, human beings looked up at the sky and they saw only cycles, the waxing and the waning of the moon, the endless arc of the sun and the stars, and they concluded that life on earth mirrored life in heaven. No one could live a truly revolutionary life. Human lives were an endless cycle of birth and death, one life ending, another beginning, each no different from the rest. Life, therefore, had no true meaning or purpose. There was no goal toward which to strive, nothing new to seek to accomplish. And all this, Cahill writes, was changed by a Mesopotamian man by the name of Abram, son of an idolater, his roots prosperously planted in Haran, and all of a sudden he decides to change his entire life, to leave his land, to found a faith and a family, risking everything on the belief that men and women can defy their fates, can determine their destinies. Abraham was the first individual on earth to believe in progress, to have the sense that tomorrow can be totally different and better than today. Cahill recounts, fascinatingly, how the world might have reacted to Abraham's insight. He writes, if we had lived in the second millennium BC and could have canvassed all the nations of the earth, what would they have said of Avram's journey? In most of Africa and Europe, they would have laughed at Avram's madness. His wife is barren as winter, they would say. A man cannot escape his fate. The early Greeks might have told Avram the story of Prometheus, whose quest for the fire of the gods ended in personal disaster. Do not overreach, they would advise. Come to resignation. On every continent and every society, Avram would have been given the same advice that wise men as diverse as Heraclitus, Lao Tzu, and Siddhartha would one day give their followers. Do not journey. Sit. Compose yourself by the river of life. And so Cahill argues that actually the two most important and revolutionary words in the entire Torah are often overlooked, and they appear right after Avram is commanded by God to leave the land of his forefathers and begin his life anew. We are told, Vayelech Avram. He went. He went for it. These words, Cahill writes, signal a complete departure from everything that has gone before in the long evolution of culture and sensibility. Out of Sumer, repository of the predictable, comes a man who does not know where he is going, but goes forth into the wilderness under the prompting of God. Out of the human race, which knows in its bones that all its striving must end in death, comes a leader who says he has been given an impossible promise. Out of mortal imagination comes a dream of something better, something yet to happen, something in the future. Without Abram, Cahill argues, the concepts of invention and progress would not have existed. Life as we know it would be totally different. Thus, Cahill concludes, all of us can hardly get up in the morning and cross the street without being Jewish. Most of our best words, new, adventure, surprise, future, freedom, progress, faith, and hope, all these words, he writes, are the gifts of the Jews. And so, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, under this interpretation, this month, time, is given into your hands. This is more than a delegation of power to the Jewish people to determine halachic time. It is also a statement about the link between Judaism and the freedom to change what is seemingly our fate. This freedom in time lies at the heart of what Judaism believes. Or as Saul Bellow supposedly once famously put it, we Jews have to believe in free will. We have no choice. The first law given to the people of Israel, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, under this interpretation, actually appears at the beginning of the Exodus because it is all about freedom. And here Judaism speaks counterculturally, not only in the age of Abraham, but today as well, because much of modern determinism, scientific, psychological, and economic, denies the freedom that lies at the heart of the Jewish story. As the religious physicist Stephen Barr once put it, like the pagan of old, the materialist today ends up subjecting man to the subhuman. The pagan said that his actions were controlled by the orbits of the planets and the stars. The materialist today says they are controlled by the orbits of the electrons in his brain. The pagan bowed down to animals or the likeness of animals in worship. The materialist today avers that he himself is no more than animal. The pagan spoke of fate. The materialist today speaks of physical determinism. And though the Jews are not now cyclically stuck in the same day, there was a time when we once were. For we were once slaves, utterly unfree to choose the course of our lives. And every day for us was the same as the last. And that is why the first mitzvah given in Egypt was time. The calendar was God's first gift to the Jewish people. On the eve of the Exodus, God gave us time, something that we could not truly appreciate as slaves. Because for the slave, every day is Groundhog Day. Every day is the same. As Rav Soloveitchik writes, for the slave, life is a motionless affair. Life is at a standstill. What the slave failed to do yesterday, he can make up today. The slave lacks the excitement of opportunities knocking on the door, lacks tense expectations and fear of failure. The slave never fails, but he never succeeds either. In contrast, the Jews were given time as their first mitzvah because it is the very symbol of freedom. This is a line in the Haggadah that is so important, but which we often miss. Yachol Merosh Chodesh, Talmud Lomar Bayomahu. The Haggadah says that one might have thought, had the Torah not made it clear that we start observing the Seder on the 15th of Nisan, one might have thought that you start observing the Festival of Liberty from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Why would we have thought that? The Jews didn't physically leave Egypt until the 15th. Why would you have thought? Why would you even have, as we say in the yeshiva, the Hava Amina? Why would one have even had the supposition that the Festival of Freedom begins on Rosh Chodesh? The answer is because it was on the 1st of Nisan that we were given the charge of sanctifying time. And that is the ability to affect time is what separates slave from free man. When we become free, we are responsible for how we spend our days. And when we are free then, free in time, every moment brings new opportunities. As Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, to truly live in time, to feel its rhythm, is to feel the obligation to move from the memory of the past to the unreality of the future, from reminiscing to anticipating. Time awareness also contains a moral element, he notes, responsibility for emerging events and intervention in the historical process. Man, according to Judaism, should try to mold and fashion the future. That is exactly why, he says, man has been created as a free agent. There is no need for freedom if only transient and marginal decisions are at stake. As such, writes Rav Soloveitchik, today with the birth of freedom, when we are free to impact the world, with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, time becomes incredibly precious. Or as he puts it, Jews cherish the fleeting moment as if it represented eternity. Every year is valuable. Every second is precious. An old and famous joke describes a law professor grading exams. Going through an exam booklet, he comes upon one page and he sees that a student has written to the professor as follows. The student writes, "Professor, I want you to know that if I had 1 hour left to live, I would want to spend that hour sitting in your class." The professor is very flattered. Then he turns the page and he sees that the student continues as follows. He writes, "Because, Professor, an hour in your class feels like an eternity." For us, for the Jews, Every moment can determine the eternity of our lives and the eternity of Klal Yisrael. My grandfather once, off the cuff, related a remarkable insight regarding the Jewish calendar, regarding what lays at the heart of Achodesh Azeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim. Homiletical, reflecting on the parlance of the sages as well as the parlance of our times, but incredibly profound. He noted that in American society, the day today is divided into 24 hours, and each hour is divided into 60 minutes. For the Jewish calendar, in its calculations, the day is divided also into 24 hours, and then each hour is divided into 1,080 units of time, called by the rabbis, chalakim. Chalak means a portion. So, if you do the math, you divide an hour by 1,080 chalakim, how long is each chalak? Carry the one. So it works out to being each chalak is 3 1/3 seconds long. My grandfather further noted that the word minute implies something small, insignificant, while the term chalak for rabbis is a word utilized to connote something that is important. Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chalak ba'olam haba. All of Israel has a chalak, a portion in the world to come. So you have the word minute, which is 60 seconds long, and it's described as something small and insignificant. You have a unit of time for the rabbis that is much smaller than that, much shorter than that, 3.3 seconds. And yet it is called a chalak. It is significant. The lesson, said my grandfather, is that for Judaism, no period of time is unimportant. To paraphrase the professor in our anecdote, for Judaism, 1 hour or even less can make a difference, an eternity of difference in Judaism. How we spend one chalak of time can determine whether we earn our chalak in the world to come. It is with this in mind that we may now return to the foods with which we began, the symbolic significance of chametz and matzah, beginning with what is today the beginning of our standard text of the Haggadah, B'tigat chametz and biur chametz, the obligation of ridding ourselves of all chametz owned by us in our homes. Usually, destruction in the Bible is reserved for something that embodies a value or an idea that disgusts us. Thus, in the Torah, it is usually pagan objects that are destined for this form of eradication. Search it out and destroy. So we are told in the Torah in Devarim. But what we do every year, finding bread and then burning it, as if it's something horrific to us, not something that you often see happening in society today in general, in modernity. Though it does happen from time to time. Thus, to speak personally, some of you may know that I'm from Chicago. I was raised in Chicago. Cubs fan. I don't want to shock any of you, but the Cubs were not always a good baseball team. Very famously in 1994, when they were 5 games away, or 93, when they were 5 games away from going on to the World Series, a long fly ball was about to be caught when a fan by the name of Steve Bartman interfered. And then the Cubs collapsed, and that was the end of that. That ball was recovered, and it was sold for over $100,000 to Harry Carey's restaurant in Chicago, which declared that it was going to destroy it. Apparently, they saw it as some totem of evil, which needed to be exploded. And so they hired the guy who did special effects for Jurassic Park to explode it. The Chicago Historical Society made an appeal to spare the ball's life. They wanted the ball to have an honorable place in its museum. But the governor of Illinois at the time, a famous statesman by the name of Rod Blagojevich, said, quote, "I have no intention whatsoever of exercising my right to grant clemency or pardon or reprieve. That baseball has got to go." I would just note that though we did not win the World Series for 108 years, we were for a long time Illinois, number one in the number of governors spending time in federal prison. Okay? Now, newspapers, and the ball was destroyed. $100,000 exploded. Newspapers further report various suggestions offered by Chicagoans as to what to do with the ball before they decided to explode it. Here were some of the suggestions. roast it, incinerate it, crush it, drown it, drop it into a bucket of acid, split it in two with an axe, put it in front of a firing squad, launch it into outer space, shove it into a shredder, scatter its remains at sea, freeze it in liquid nitrogen and shatter it into a million pieces, and my favorite suggestion, bury the ball at midnight in Yankee Stadium. But the truth is, though we laugh at this, there is a similar symposium found among the sages. This is in the Mishnah. How, ask the rabbis, is the obligation of biur chametz, destroying chametz, to be performed? How is a Jew who owns chametz, as Pesach is upon us, to destroy this forbidden object? And the sages make several suggestions. Zor kol liyam, he can throw the chametz into the sea. Mefarer v'zor el ruach, he can crumble up the bread and scatter it into the wind. And finally, Rabbi Yehuda insists, Rabbi Judah says, Ein biur chametz ela srefa. Only burning the chametz is severe enough to suffice. That, and that alone, is what is called for in getting rid of chametz. Now, what is the debate here? What is the root of this strange symposium of the sages? It was Rabbi Chaim of Soloveitchik of Brisk who suggested, using the classical conceptual language for which he was known, that what is taking place here is more than a mere machloket, a debate as to how to destroy chametz. Rather, what is taking place is a fundamental disagreement as to why we must get rid of chametz itself. For the sages, the main obligation is just to make sure that you don't have any leaven, any chametz on your property. So you get rid of it. It doesn't matter how. Scatter it to the wind, throw it in the river, whatever you want. The obligation, to use Rabbi Chaim of Brisk's parlance, is on the gavra. It is a personal obligation to ensure that he confronts no chametz over Passover. But Rabbi Judah, Rabbi Yehuda, who insists on burning the chametz, he believes that the obligation to destroy the leaven lies in the chefza, meaning in the object. There is something metaphysically inherently offensive about chametz that on Pesach inherently obligates its utter annihilation. Now, interestingly, the law is in accordance with the sages, that all you have to do is get rid of your chametz before Pesach. But Jewish tradition developed, and so it is recorded at the beginning of the Haggadah, to act just a little bit in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda, that we save a bit of chametz and we burn it before Pesach. What's the purpose of this? Why would we do this? The answer lies in the Torah's insistence that as free men and women, we are obligated to spend time, our time, wisely and well. For how does chametz come about? Leaven develops, and leaven is not the precise term. Chametz comes about by letting a dough just sit there. It is true that we try to bake matzah within 18 minutes, but according to law, according to halakha, as long as the dough is being worked with, even for several hours, it cannot become chametz. It is only when nothing is done with the dough, when it is allowed to rise on its own, that chametz appears on the scene. And this takes a great deal of time in the ancient world, in an age before baking powder or other artificial forms of leavening. Originally, the way chametz was produced was by the addition to a dough of what the Torah calls seor, which means starter, a starter dough. And you would add a little bit to the dough, and then it would take some time for the dough to rise. Both chametz and seor, the starter dough and the leaven that it helps produce, are banned on Passover. As Gil Marx notes in his Magisterial Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, dough leavened with starter requires a lengthy pre-fermentation process, a much longer time than that needed for modern commercial yeast. Making a starter itself can be a long and complicated process. It takes at least 5 days and commonly up to 2 weeks of it just sitting there. That is the leavening process, which means that chametz is the symbol of procrastination and the wasting of time, of putting off till tomorrow what we ought to have done today, of passing up opportunities for growth, of letting time, precious time, go to waste. That chametz and the Jewish approach to time are linked can be seen most directly from one of the most famous of Talmudic dictums, mitzvah haba liyadcha, if a mitzvah, an opportunity to perform a good deed, comes to your hands, al tachmitzena, do not do chametz, do not delay, do not miss that opportunity. And that, perhaps, is why once a year we destroy chametz. Chametz symbolizes ideals ignored, dreams delayed, time intentionally wasted. We need a shock to our system, because year after year, we forget that the lesson of liberty lies in time. We are supposed to be acting in time, not the way bread is produced in ancient times or chametz is produced in ancient times, but the way matzah is produced, the way it was created in Pesach originally, bechipazon, with swiftness, with alacrity, and the way people act in a matzah bakery today, if you have ever visited one, where not one moment of time can be wasted. And that's why matzah is the very symbol of liberty. Because for Judaism, liberty is not the freedom to do nothing. With freedom comes the extraordinary obligations of what it means to live in time and what it means to sanctify time. We destroy the antithesis of matzah, chametz, once a year because we need to remind ourselves what liberty is all about. Ezra Soloveitchik writes, unfortunately, not every human being takes advantage of the unique human endowment to experience time, to live time rather than to live in time. Many human beings, he writes, float with the tide of time because there is no alternative to it. Time, he writes, is an all-powerful, irresistible force for these people. True freedom, in other words, is to be the master of our time. Chametz, to paraphrase Rabbi Soloveitchik, chametz is an object that leavens as it floats in the tides of time, whereas the making of matzah embodies a man or woman living life with alacrity, one who is a master of time. And so, before Pesach, we destroy the symbol of our procrastination in order to emphasize that now we are getting a new start. We seek to inspire ourselves to live life with alacrity and to give every bit of time the attention that it deserves, because otherwise time is all too apt to slip through our fingers. And so the Pesach season begins this Shabbat. It begins with Rosh Chodesh Nisan, with the commemoration of when we were first given the calendar, when time was first placed in our hands. And the season climaxes on Pesach Eve, when we destroy chametz, the very symbol of our failure to embrace the responsibility that is freedom in time. From this perspective, the first few pages of the Haggadah as it exists as a text today, these pages are not meant to be seen merely as a series of unrelated rituals, but rather as a process of reminding ourselves through a series of interrelated actions what it truly means to be free and what time is supposed to mean to all of us. Standard Haggadah today begins with the search for chametz, with the bracha, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kidshanu Mitzvot Vitzvanu, Al Bi'ur Chametz. God, you have commanded us to seek out and destroy the symbol of the wasting of time. Then, after we take chametz and we burn it, reminding ourselves of the responsibilities that arise from freedom in time, and the link between the nation of Israel's impact on the history of ideas and our covenantal obligation as Jews to sanctify time, we then engage in the ritual known as bitul, where we declare any chametz left in our possession as valueless. It is a striking statement if you think about it. Kol chamira v'chamia de'ika birashuti. Any leavened products that are left in my possession, livatel v'levi hefker, they shall be nullified in my perspective, and they shall be like the dust of the earth. Why do we need to say this? The answer is because we act in time through most of the year in a way that shows that we do not understand what is truly valuable. In my first year in the rabbinate, when I was a rabbi on the Upper East Side, a member of my synagogue came to me with the following question. He had had over at a Seder the night before a non-observant Jew. This Jew wanted to be polite, so he was invited over for the Seder, so you bring a gift. And as a gift, the guest brought his host a bottle of wine and a $100 bottle of scotch. Okay? Now, scotch is chametz. Okay, so he said to me, what can I do? Can I just put it with the other chametz that I've already sold to a non-Jew? And I said to him, no, because chametz can only be sold before Pesach. On Pesach, chametz cannot be sold. You have in your possession chametz that was owned by a Jew. You are obligated biblically to destroy it. And so he said to me, Oh, I'm sorry I asked. Okay. And I responded, on the contrary, how often do you get to do the mitzvah of destroying chametz on Pesach itself? You don't usually get to do that, because the only way to do it usually is by doing something wrong, by not destroying it beforehand. But this is not your fault. So you get to do the actual mitzvah. What a great opportunity. He didn't seem that excited. Anyhow, but he did listen to me. And I told him, you have to destroy it. I said, please do not burn your scotch. I said, you pour it down the sink in the bathroom, not in the sink in your kitchen. You pour it down the sink in your bathroom. And he did. He opened up this expensive bottle of scotch that day, poured it down the drain. Later on Chol HaMoed, he called me to tell me that right after Yom Tov, he had been presented with a wonderful new job opportunity. And he thought that that was granted to him by God in merit of his courageous decision to listen to me and destroy the scotch. Thus did my fame as a Hasidic Rebbe and miracle worker grow and grow. But the truth is, that as delicious as scotch may be, and it is indeed delicious, our values are often misplaced. Or as Oscar Wilde once put it, the cynic knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing. Our value system throughout much of the year is misplaced. The Torah does not treasure scotch or challah or cake or cookies, and certainly not hamantaschen, the worst Jewish food ever produced, and an offense against both God and man. Truth is, none of these are truly valued. In the Beit HaMikdash, and this is often missed, all of the bread offered on the altar and the showbread that stood before God every week, none of these were chametz. These were all matzah, with the exception of one or two times of the year where chametz is used in ritual, but even then not presented on the altar. The Beit HaMikdash was most of the time, and the altar was all of the time, kosher for Passover all year round. Only matzah is offered on the table of the divine. Why, says the Talmud? Because in preparing the bread for the Beit HaMikdash, Kohanim, the priests, are zrizin. They are zariz. They act with alacrity. There is no wasting of the preciousness of time when you truly feel that you stand in the presence of God. And so, the statement that we engage in right before the Seder, the morning before the Seder, all chametz that I have left in my possession should be nullified in my heart, valueless, is teaching us that often our value system is misapplied. Truth is, unlike single malt, the soul does not improve through years of just sitting there, through decades of inactivity. On the contrary, Jewish lives are meant to be lived in the way that matzot were made on the first Passover, bechipazon, with quickness, with every moment properly seized, with the knowledge that it is time's very finitude that gives each moment infinite value. That is what we are expressing when we search out for our chametz, when we cathartically destroy our chametz, and then when we renounce the value of our chametz. And then, ladies and gentlemen, what do we do next in the Haggadah? Then we come that evening to our homes, and we sit at our Seder as free men and women, and we begin the festival of freedom. We start the Seder with Kadesh, with the ritual of Kiddush, which is, of course, nothing other than the ultimate embodiment of our obligation to sanctify time. And at that point, we recite with profundity and with joy as we sanctify that day and the time that is upon us. Vatitan lanu Hashem Elokeinu bi'ahava et yom chag hamatzot hazeh zman chirutenu, thereby reminding us again of the preciousness of time and how matzah, more than any other object or symbol, represents how precious time actually is. And then, of course, understanding time's very finitude and therefore how exquisite each moment is, we use the time that we have to ensure our immortality, not by assuming that we will live forever, but by knowing that our own time is limited, and we thereby extend our own time on earth by transmitting our truths and our worldview and our traditions to our posterity. Many Ashkenazic Jews, strikingly, have the tradition of wearing a kittel, the white garment worn on Yom Kippur, also at the Seder. This is strange, because the white garment is an embodiment of tachrichim, of death garments. It's worn on Yom Kippur to remind us that we will one day die. So why would we do this at the Seder? But of course, in a more joyous way, reminding ourselves that we are mortal is a way of teaching us the preciousness of time and how time can only be extended through what takes place throughout the Seder with our children. It was the historian Richard Brookhiser who notes that in the movie Groundhog Day, the curse is lifted when Bill Murray blesses the day he has just lived. And his reward, writes Brookhiser, is that the day is taken from him, because loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. Loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. That is what we mean when we engage in Kiddush after the day-long process of ridding ourselves of chametz. That is what we mean when we speak of Zman Chirutenu as Yom Chag HaMatzot HaZeh. That is what we are thinking when we transmit the Haggadah to our children. Because at that moment at the Seder, we are intended, above all, to ponder an insight once said by Thoreau, that it is impossible for us to kill time without injuring our eternity. Thank you very much.